Okay. All right. So I've reviewed complexity of representations of people and affective quality of representations. And I've talked about emotional investment in relationships. So, you know, as I mentioned, emotional investment in values and moral standards is also developmentally sensitive. So the older you become, you know, from preschool, toddlerhood to preschool to middle school years to adolescence, et cetera, you're presumably going to become more invested in values and moral standards. You know, if you're a toddler and a kid steals your toy in the playground, you're going to punch him. But you're less likely to do that if you are, you know, sitting in a lab meeting and someone takes your umbrella. So we would expect people to become more emotionally invested in both relationships and values and moral standards as they get older. Of course, there's a lot of individual differences here. The fifth dimension is understanding of social causality, a very important dimension that I like a lot. And this is a dimension in which people with autism, people on the autism spectrum, don't do very well. They have a lot of difficulty understanding social causality. What do I mean by social causality? Social causality. Social causality is one's understanding that the way someone behaves and treats another person has an impact, an emotional impact on the other person. So if I do this or say this to that person, they're going to feel about me a certain way. If I say something else, they're going to feel about me a different way. It's understanding that our behaviors are connected to underlying mental states, like thoughts, feelings, wishes, intentions. These mental states have a big influence on how we behave. So if I pound my fist on the table, you're going to deduce that maybe I'm feeling angry. Or if I get up and do a little jig, other than thinking I might be crazy, you're thinking, well, he's really happy, right? So our behaviors reflect how we are really feeling inside. What people with autism spectrum disorders lack is the ability to make those kinds of inferences about how other people are thinking and feeling and wishing and intending. They lack that ability to make those kinds of inferences. So they would score low on social causality. So all these dimensions are different ways. If object relations is an elephant, you know, each of these dimensions is like feeling a part of the elephant. Like, well, this is the trunk. Oh, this is a leg. Oh, this is the tail. Oh, this is an ear. But it's all part of the same elephant, which is someone's object relations. All right. So as I said earlier, each of these next 8 weeks, we're going to be taking one of these dimensions and really learning it really well and practicing how to code for that one dimension each week. All right? So that's understanding social causality. Any questions about that? So people, not only people with autism, but people with severe personality disorders, like borderline personality disorder, also make highly idiosyncratic, illogical conclusions about people's interactions. Whereas healthier individuals form more accurate attributions regarding other people's intentions. Okay? So we've got, that's five, and Oh yeah, okay. So that's five. So number six is the dimension, number six is called experience and management of aggressive impulses. So this has some overlap, this dimension has some overlap with the dimension number two, affective quality of relations, but it's specifically targeting aggression, so violence or threats of violence. So it's beyond affective quality of representations. It's really about violence and threats of violence. So so we would imagine that it's very people with borderline personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder, that their narratives are going to have a lot of violence or threats of violence or hints of violence embedded within them. And we want to kind of tease those aspects or facets of their object relations out and then code them. So you'll be reading a vignette and you'll be kind of underlining areas in the vignette that might reflect some aggression, right? And again, like all the others, this particular scale is rated from 1 to 7, like all the others. 1 being like really, really violent, aggressive, and 7 being very well modulated, meaning it's integrated with everything else in the person. Another word that we psychoanalysts often use is sublimation. Anybody ever hear that word? No? Sublimation is the ability to use aggressive impulses in a very, how should I put it, healthy and adaptive manner. So for example, a dentist. So a dentist, think about a dentist for a minute. What do they do for a living? They drill into people's teeth and they make them suffer, right? But they're, so you could argue that dentists are very aggressive people, right? Their whole livelihood is to inflict pain, but they're doing it in the service of good. And actually they're paid a lot of money to do that, because their talents are considered to be to have high value. So there's an example of sublimation where maybe a person's highly aggressive, they have a lot of aggressive impulses that are being channeled into a pursuit or career that's very lucrative, can make them a lot of money. All right? So that is dimension number six. Dimension number seven is self-esteem. So self-esteem is the extent to which the person values or esteems themselves in their narratives. Now, of course, you're going to read a narrative and sometimes self-esteem is not a theme in the narrative. And there's a particular rating that you would assign to the narrative if a particular dimension doesn't apply. All right, and we'll get into that in the coming weeks, but I'm just trying to introduce you to these eight dimensions. So self-esteem is a dimension. So self-esteem is part of object relations, right? So if you have low self-esteem, it stands to reason that that your relationship with others is going to be different than if you had high self-esteem. So self-esteem has a big impact on object relations, and that's why Drew Weston decided to create this seventh dimension of object relations. The last dimension is called identity and coherence of self, ICS. And identity and coherence of self has some overlap with self-esteem, but this more has to do with the feeling that one knows who one is. So patients with borderline personality disorder often don't have a sense, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I want. I don't know where I come from. I don't know where I'm going. So they would score low on this dimension. So coherence of self means that, you know, their values, what they represent, how they feel, it all kind of goes together. Right? So very famous movie, Taxi Driver. Anybody ever see that movie? No, never heard of it. Robert De Niro, anybody know who that is? Maybe, maybe not. He's an actor. Anyway, he starred in the movie Taxi Driver. In this movie, De Niro plays a taxi driver who is getting fit. He's going to the gym, he's lifting weights, he's really invested in his personal health. But the movie also shows him like dumping like a whole canister of sugar into his cereal. So that's a contradiction, right? Why is somebody who's trying to get healthy like has such a horrible diet? Like, that's a contradiction, right? It's not very coherent. His self representation is not very coherent. It's incoherent. It doesn't make sense. Why would someone who's trying to get healthy, you know, dump like a ton of sugar in his cereal? Why is he eating cereal in the first place? You know, I mean, maybe you know people like that. So I'm working with a patient who's trying to lose some weight, and he, you know, he's trying to get healthy, and he walks, if I'm to believe him, he walks 5 or 6 miles a day, but he smokes cigarettes while he's walking, right? So something isn't really fitting with this image of someone who wants to get healthy. And, you know, part of what we do together is to try to figure out, okay, what's going on here? You know, he has two competing wishes. One is to kind of get high from the cigarettes, and the other is to get healthy and lose weight. And these two wishes kind of compete with each other. But it just reflects the difficulty he has in creating a coherent self. It's not very coherent. So identity and coherence of self is the eighth and final dimension. And again, that's rated along 7 anchor points. So those are the 8 dimensions of the SCORES system, which is the social cognition and object relations scale. Questions? Yes, Daniel.
I'm a little bit confused about how the second one is not sensitive to the development. Can people be start out pessimistic but be more optimistic depending on how their life goes over time?
It is possible, but it's not match. Maybe a better word is maturational, meaning that if you're following a whole population of people, we wouldn't expect them to go from negative. So babies aren't born with the negative affective quality, and they gradually become more positive. Some people are born happy, and they can become gradually more pessimistic and feel that the world is a painful, threatening, dark, cold, anxious place, which isn't related to maturation. So we wouldn't hypothesize that babies grow up, babies start out, you know, threatened, angry, pessimistic, and everybody ends up being more optimistic as life goes on. We would make that assumption. But with all the other dimensions, we could make that assumption that people go from lower levels of the dimension to higher levels of the dimension. Now, not for everybody, right? Because if you have a personality disorder or some major league psychiatric diagnosis, that might not happen. Something might be interfering with your progression from low to high. But on this particular dimension, there is no natural maturational process that pushes along affective quality from minus to plus. Does that help?
Okay, so it's 'cause it's not predictable.
Right. Exactly. So time is not a predictor. Let's put it that way. Other questions? Yes, Charles.
First one. So there's, in this paragraph, it says splitting should decrease with a greater tolerance of ambiguity and conflict. Just kind of confused with that sentence.
Right, so splitting is this fracturing process that I was talking about, where you view somebody as being all bad or all good. Right? So people really aren't like that. People have good and bad. Everybody, the assumption is that people have good and bad in them, that everybody has some good and some bad, that there are no people who are all bad and people who are all good. There is a mixture of people. And so this tolerance of ambiguity means that you can tolerate the badness in someone, but still work with them and get along with them. Like when I was at my previous university, LIU, I didn't get along with every one of my colleagues, but I knew I could tolerate the ambiguity or the ambivalence that I felt in the relationship because we had a common goal, which was to train future psychologists, and we all agreed on that goal. So we all had something in common. I didn't personally like everybody on the faculty, but we all got along because we all agreed that we were here to train future psychologists, and we did a damn good job of it. I have enough of integration of my representations to be able to tolerate people who I don't personally like. But people who are engaged in splitting, they can't stand the person. They will never be in the room with that person. You see the difference? I mean, I'm trying to make the difference very dramatic so you kind of get the point, but people actually engage in splitting in at different levels. And that's why all of these scales are graded from 1 to 7. It's not either or. Either yes, they don't engage in splitting, or yes, they do engage in splitting. There's a qualitative difference or quantitative difference across 7 different levels. Does that help? Okay. What else? Daniel.
A little confused with the number 7, which on the self-esteem.
Yep.
And so how is that predicted to change over development and time?
Well, as a child grows older, they grow in confidence. And we would expect that children who get older become more self-confident, more trusting of adults to help them, as well as more self-reliant, right? But self-reliant comes from a sense that I can do this, I can do that. I am, you know, strong enough, I am smart enough, good looking enough, you know, I can do this. But those are qualities that develop over time. And so we would expect toddlers, preschoolers, middle school kids, pre-adolescents, adolescents, you know, to increase in their self-confidence and their self-esteem. So that's why Weston identified that dimension as being one of those that's developmentally sensitive, that we would expect maturationally people would be expected to have higher self-esteem as they get older. Now, that's not always true, but just generally, that would be the trend. We wouldn't expect kids to have high self-esteem and then everybody just maturationally would develop less self-esteem as they get older. it's, we would hypothesize the opposite. And so if someone has low self-esteem and they're an adult, okay, what went wrong, right? What intervention took place that got them off track from the trajectory, a positive trajectory of positive self-esteem? You know, did they lose a parent? Were they bullied? You know, did their parents lose their jobs and they became impoverished? You know, and they internalized that. I'm not worthy of sleeping in my own bed. I have to sleep in my bed with my brother and sister. You know, that kind of a thing. So that's why we would argue that that would be a developmentally sensitive dimension as well. What else? This group has to curb their enthusiasm. I think that's the problem. It's right, Elisa?
Yes.
Usually tell them about my lab. It's usually a lot more lively, right?
It is. It's quite lively. But you know what? We're missing Jeremy, you know?
That's true.
He brings a lot of life to the party.
You are correct. Jeremy was one of my students last year, and he brought a lot of energy to the party. But anyway, what other questions do you have, if any? I also attached those two other coding systems, and it was optional for you to look them over, but if you have an interest in creating a poster, which I talked about last week, it's important to know how the data set that we're going to be working on encoding using this system, what previous variables have been coded on the same data set. Because, you know, hypotheses have to do with postulating relationships among variables, right? So it might be important to understand what the other variables that are already in existence, what they are, so that you can create a hypothesis that might include the variables that have already been coded using the same data set. Now, again, I wasn't expecting anybody to have a hypothesis formulated today, but I do want to point out that the deadline for submitting an abstract for a poster is probably in early or mid-December. Maybe, Elisa, you can look that up for the APA, what the poster deadline is.
Yeah, I'll look that up right now.
Okay, thanks. So whatever the deadline is, you're going to have to submit it to me a week or two ahead of time because I want to be able to polish it and make some revisions and so forth. So an abstract is usually a description of what it is you want to accomplish in your poster. It's usually 200, 250 words, something like that. And then you submit that to the APA, and then they review it, and there's a group of reviewers, and they will review your poster idea and either give you a thumbs up, you've been accepted, or a thumbs down, no, you haven't been accepted. And I had sent out a poster after our last meeting. Did everybody get a chance to take a look at that? It was our poster from last year, which Elisa worked on. Any questions about that poster? Nope. Okay. I could also send out the abstract that we submitted last year for that poster. Would you like to see the abstract and give you a sense of what is going to be required to submit in December? So let me make a note to myself to do that. What else? Elisa, you have anything you want to add?
I can't seem to find when the submission deadline is. It seems that their site they said is currently closed. It opens on November 8th, but I don't know. They're not showing me the deadlines.
Okay.
But,
so probably the submission portal opens on November 8th, but there should be a place where they tell you like when the deadline is and what the word length is for the abstract. It's possible that they don't have that up yet, but I think it's going to, somebody told me last week it's going to be in D.C., Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's going to be in D.C. Next year.
Okay. I'm seeing it says May 20th to the 24th, 2023 in San Francisco, California.
No, you're looking at the wrong, the American Psychological Association, right?
Yeah, I was looking at the APA.
Well, there's the American Psychiatric Association, too.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. It's often confusing because they have the same, it's the same acronym.
Yeah, there it is. Okay. That's probably why I can't figure out the submission
deadline. All right. No problem.
Okay, I'll be back on it then.
All right. So there's, I guess there's one other thing I want to share tonight before we stop, and that is that, so I'm going to be teaching you two versions of this coding system. This isn't super important right now, but I just want to put it out there. So we're going to be learning the score system called the Scores G, and the G stands for global. It's the global system, and it's the one it's the more popular of the two coding systems. And we're going to learn this one first because I think it's a little bit easier to learn and master and grasp the concepts. So the Scores G is these eight dimensions that we just discussed. You rate each one on a scale from 1 to 7 with the anchor points. And then so every vignette, every narrative has how many scores? I want to see if you're paying attention. So every vignette will have how many scores? It's a math problem. If there are eight dimensions, there'll be eight scores. Thank you. So every vignette, every narrative will have eight different scores representing each of the eight different dimensions. And each of those scores will vary from what to what?
1 to 7.
Thank you, Nicole. From 1 to 7. So you get 8 different scores. Each one will be a number from 1 to 7. Okay? So that's the Scores G. The other scores coding system, which is less often used, but which we ended up using last year and which we'll use again this year, is called the Scores Q. And the Scores Q is the same idea, except it uses something called Q-sort methodology. And Q-sort methodology is a system in which you have a certain number of items, 93 items actually, and you rate these 93 items in, you put them in various piles, okay? And we have it all electronic, so you can actually drag and drop the items into the various piles. And we found last year that the Scores Q seems to work better for psychotherapy transcripts than the Scores G. The Scores G is really good for TAT vignettes. I think I mentioned that last week. TAT's thematic apperception test, Rorschach responses. It's good for these short little vignettes, but it doesn't work as well for these longer psychotherapy transcripts, which can be like 10, 15 pages long. So the Scores Q is better equipped. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you the Scores G, and then we're going to make a transition into the Scores Q. Because there is going to be kind of a learning curve to move from one to the other, from the Scores G to the Scores Q. It's the same ideas, the same concepts, the same facets of object relations that you're going to be applying. However, the methodology is a little different, and it's going to take some adjustment. So I just want to prepare you for that. That'll be happening probably right around the time the end of the fall semester. And then in January, we'll come back from break, and we'll really focus on getting up to speed on the scores queue. And then we can actually code the real data. Questions? All right, Elisa, did you find it?
No, I'm having poor luck on it.
Okay.
I will continue to search, and I'll email you if I find it.
All right, that's cool. And then I can just send it out to the group.
Yeah. So they are learning it the same way that we learned it.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because I think that worked okay, right?
I think that worked really well. I think it was really helpful to know how each of the different scales kind of function in order to then see the entire cue set.
Yeah.
Because the questions are a bit more in depth.
That's what I thought too. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So what I'm going to do is, either tonight or tomorrow morning, I'm going to send out the reading for next week. We're going to focus on the complexity of representations, the first dimension, COM, C-O-M. And I am going to also send out the practice vignettes. And so you're going to read all about COM, and then you're going to apply what you've learned to these practice vignettes. Okay? And you'll have the anchor points, and you'll be able to refer to the anchor points. You'll be able to refer to the reading. It's not a lot of reading. It's actually quite minimal, but it should give you a better sense of how to go about the coding. And then what you're going to do is, by Monday night, right, I need you to send me your ratings. So the rows will be the vignette numbers. So vignette 1, vignette 2, vignette 3, vignette 4. And then you'll just put the number that you assign to the vignette next to the vignette number. So let's say vignette 1, you read it and you score it. Oh, that's a 6. Remember, it's a scale from 1 to 7. So that's a 6. So then with the first row, you put a 6 next to the first row. As you read the second vignette, oh, that's a 2. That's pretty low. It's a 2. So then second row, you put a 2. In Excel, save the Excel file. Be sure to put your name in the file name so that I know who you are. Hi, we're wrapping up.
I know. Oh, I just got back from because of commute and traffic, and I commute from home, so
okay.
I realized that it was traffic was so much more than I was.
Okay, all right. Well, you're welcome to come in. You're Sage Lynn.
I am.
Excuse me. Okay.
Thank you. That was great.
Okay, so I'm sitting here, but you can sit anywhere else. This is Elisa, my lab coordinator. She's from New York. She's a master's student at Columbia University studying clinical psychology.
I actually called her because I couldn't figure out how to get here. I was like, I couldn't find the building and anything. So I actually called her.
Oh, okay.
And I pick up because meeting was in progress, understandably.
I was wondering what that random call was.
It was me.
I thought it was spam. Sorry.
Not spam, but she's for real. So Sage Lean was not here last week, but she contacted me, I think, the evening
mm-hmm.
after the first lab meeting and
yeah.
begged me to join. So I said, okay, all right, we'll take one more person.
So,
did you listen to the podcast?
I did. I listened, okay. And I emailed you about the podcast as well and asked a few questions.
Okay, you did that recently?
Yesterday. Right before break.
before break?
Yes. I emailed you and I asked you about the transcripts and whether whether we'd make we'd be finding our own transcripts or whether we'd be using your other your
okay.
previous.
Did I didn't get that, did I?
You responded.
Did I respond?
Yes.
Okay. That's
yes.
good I responded.
Yeah, maybe it was just an easy question.
So you have any other questions?
So you told me that they were collected at your previous institution and that we would not be collecting any more transcripts.
Correct.
To use. So
correct.
Yes.
So we have a data set that's all ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Left here.
Yeah.
I also my other question was, would we be working with like pharmacists with like drugs and like patients that are transcripts that are specifically with patients on drugs versus for patients that are not getting like drugs with help with the
Right. So this person was not taking any medication.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually one person, a patient, with one therapist.
Yes.
And we have a collection of sessions, many sessions,
yeah.
with this one patient and this one therapist. But this patient was not taking medication.
Will we be looking at their transcripts and patients that like were taking?
One patient.
Control?
We're looking at only one patient for the entire year. It's one dyad. It's a therapeutic dyad. So this is a single case study with multiple sessions. So with this kind of research, the sessions become the sample size.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It's interesting. I'd be intrigued to know what kind of research that will be we could do on that. It would be very data oriented for sure.
Yes, well, this is a quantitative coding system. So
mm-hmm.
we're going to be coding all the sessions that these two folks were engaged in over a period of years.
When I read the reading, I kind of understood it a little bit. When I read the reading about that there was like four things that we're looking for, one of them was object differentiation, I think, object relative activity.
Well, there were eight. So if you read the reading for today, there are eight dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
that we're going to be studying this
yes.
fall. And I recommend you listen to this podcast as well.
Yes.
Because I talk about the eight dimensions. But differentiation is one of the qualities of the first dimension, which is calm, complexity of representations. So differentiation and integration are what we're looking for in that first dimension, which is actually the dimension that we're going to be really targeting next week. I'm going to focus on that dimension as the first dimension, and so I'm going to be sending out reading on that first dimension and giving you a little homework assignment, coding some practice vignettes using the rating scale for complexity of representations. So there are eight different rating scales. They comprise the coding system known as Scores G.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's different from just Scores without the G.
Well, Scores G, the G stands for global, so there's a way you can actually combine all the scales together into like one overarching, score. That's why it's called G for global, but there are eight, it's comprised of eight different dimensions. So we're gonna focus on each dimension every week and really get it down before we move forward. How's that? Good?
I do understand it. Yeah.
Okay. I also mentioned the idea of a poster presentation, and if you have an interest in that, be thinking about what kind of hypothesis you'd want to test. And I sent out two additional coding systems, not that we're going to be learning them this year, but that these are coding systems that have already been previously applied to the data set that we're going to be studying this year. So those are variables that are already waiting, just dying to be correlated with what we're going to be doing.
Do we get to really get to see more transcripts of her, of this dyad, that we will be like looking at? Will we be comparing and contrasting every single like session, or?
Well, you're gonna be coding each session independently of all the other sessions,
okay.
So it's hard to do, right? Because, I give you session number 42, and then I might give you session number 29, and then session 55. And you're going to try your best to block out anything else you know about this dyad and just focus on that session, what the session says.
Interesting. So like if we look at this session, we found out that she was having like marital issues with, and we have to like look at the next one and not pay attention
exactly.
to the fact.
Exactly. In fact, the more you don't forget and remember, the more it's going to bias you in future coding, which is a problem.
Okay.
Right, because if you read one session, it's very dramatic, and if you allow that to influence your coding, some of this goes on unconsciously. We're not aware of it, but if you let it influence your future coding, then the coding that you're providing to that second session is not really reflective of that session, it's reflective of the previous session, and we can't have that. Because then all the coding is going to be roughly the same.
Right.
It's going to be based on the very first session you coded.
That is interesting.
Right? And so the data are going to be worthless. But what we're going to do is we're going to when we get ready to code the real sample, I'm going to pair you up into pairs. And then you're going to have to establish inter-rater reliability with your partner. So you two will be coding the transcript completely independently of each other. And then you're going to send me your scores independently, and then I'm going to correlate them and assess your reliability. So you're going to have to see things the way your partner sees
them.
So this
will be more qualitative than
qualitative? No, it's quantitative. It's quantitative because ultimately each pair's scores are going to be composited.
Okay.
And then it's the composite score that's going to be used in the data analysis.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, I'm excited. Most of my lab work has been like more of like wet lab and like taking measurements of things. So that I'm actually more, I'm very curious to see how this works.
Well, this is taking measurements, but it's in a different
way
than what you're used to.
Yeah.
We're taking measurements, all right. We're measuring the quality of object relations in these narratives. These narratives are psychotherapy transcripts. So the unit of measurement is the psychotherapy transcript, and we're applying this coding system onto the psychotherapy transcript.
I'm excited.
Great.
Yeah.
Someone's excited. Any other questions? Yes,
so
Carolina.
Related to the score tier and everything, but last week we talked about possibly meeting like on campus. Is that still a possibility? Because I'm happy to like take the lead on that and see if I can find a room.
It's a possibility. I
would love to help you. The way the traffic took me 30 minutes to get here. I started on time, I swear.
Yeah,
I live actually a mile from campus.
Yeah.
And I take the shuttle bus to campus. But this is where my office is.
Right.
I don't really care. So if it's more convenient for you to meet on campus, you'd be responsible for finding the location for us. I mean, we're usually, there's some people who aren't here today, but we're going to be a group of 12 or so.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find a comfortable location for us every Wednesday from 4:45 to 6, I'm more than happy to go to main campus.
There's sometimes they have conferences rooms that are open at the psych building. That no one are
I don't even know where the psych building is. I'm in Department of Psychiatry, and that's this campus. This is where my office is, just on the other side of these offices here.
Which classes do you teach?
I teach in the Psychoanalytic Institute.
Hmm.
So I teach
the School of Medicine.
Huh?
So like in the School of Medicine.
In the Department of Psychiatry in the School of Medicine. So I'm teaching child and adolescent psychopathology and development.
Cool. I love psychopathology.
You're in the right place.
Yeah.
So just let me know and give me a heads up, You know, like don't contact me at 4 p.m. and say, hey, we're meeting on campus. Don't do that.
Yeah, I'll try to find something by like this weekend. And I can reply to
it. Yeah, yeah, that would be great. That would be great. I mean, as I said, my office is here, but I'm happy to make it more convenient for students.
Yeah, okay.
And certainly people coming in late, I mean, no offense, but people coming in late is disruptive, and I don't want that, you know. So whatever I can do to facilitate people being on time, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, yeah, I'll send an email if I find something.
Okay.
It also didn't help that my house, I live off campus, and I live with my parents, so it's a 20-minute commute from school, and I assumed it would be at, like, Emory, and I didn't realize Executive Park was, like, 30 minutes away.
Yeah, it's totally, psychiatry is completely on a different campus.
It's okay, we're just on a different level of the mind.
All right, so I will see you next week. Thank you.
Sorry, again.
It happens. Just be sure you listen to the podcast. That's going to be important. All right.
Okay.
All right.
If anyone can hear
that
if I transit, I can drive them back.
I mean, you can ask. Anybody need a ride back to campus? Anybody take the shuttle?
Do you guys want? I can take you guys home in the car.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Have a
good day. All
right.
I'll see you. Yep. Let me just finish up with Elisa. Okay. All right. So, I'm going to send out the assignment for next week. You're on the email chain, so I think we're good. If you can just let me know about the APA.
Yeah, I just sent you an email with their website but they just give the dates of the next convention. They don't give me a deadline. They have the old deadline, so I'm assuming it's, like you said, going to be like December or early January, but I'm not finding their deadline yet. So
okay, all right. And what was the old deadline from last year was what, December, what, 11th or?
It was extended to January 10th, but if I remember correctly, you did have, I think you emailed us that it was like December 13th or something like that. It was like earlier December.
That's usually when it is. And maybe that was pandemic related.
I'm assuming so, because COVID.
Right. So maybe it's going to go back to...
Yeah.
I wouldn't assume that's going to be in January.
Yeah, no. I'm assuming that's probably going to be more December-ish. I'll keep looking and see if maybe I'm just not looking in the right area or something. But yeah.
Okay. All right.
It seemed like a good bunch.
A little quiet.
We'll bring the life into them.
I hope so. All right. Thanks, Lisa. And you're going to meet with Brian when you said tomorrow. Okay, great.
Yeah, tomorrow afternoon. And then this is a good time for me, so I should be able to make it to most meetings.
Great. You can help me teach this coding system.
I would love to. It's a good coding system. I think it'll bring the life and the joy into them.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. Wow. All right. I'll see you next week.
Take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Care.
Thank you.